I might add, well, in the interests of justice, I want to say who saved his life. It was James Monroe, who was minister to France. And when he found out what Paine's plight was, he immediately got him released. James Monroe's antecedent in his job was a wretch by the name of Gouverneur Morris, who was one of the American conservatives, if you'll pardon the expression, of the period. And they were conserving not so much the freedom that Paine had promoted, but rather the more monarchic and Tory-like philosophy, and he hated Paine with a purple passion. As a matter of fact, that's Gouverneur Morris. And when he was the minister to France, Gouverneur Morris made it very, very hard for Paine to survive, because as an American citizen, his job was to get him out. Instead, he not only let him rot in prison, he kept this information from the then President of the United States, George Washington, who probably would have done something had he known. But he didn't know that Paine was in prison. And unfortunately, this produced one of the greatest misunderstandings in history, for which Paine has paid a great price. Paine did not know that Washington didn't know that he was in prison. And he acted understandably angry. When he came out of prison, he was under the impression that Washington as president had left him to die. And he was thoroughly boiling with rage, because he knew he had founded the United States and that Washington wouldn't have a country to be president of if he hadn't done what he did, and he was furious with Washington for having left him to die. If Washington had known that he was in prison, Washington would have deserved this, but it is very probable. Most historical evidence is that Washington didn't even know he was in prison. But be that as it may, Paine didn't know that Washington didn't know, and he wrote a very angry and wrong denunciation of George Washington's character, for which Thomas Paine has paid a historical price, in that many historians have taken that out against Paine for his denunciation of Washington, who, as you know, is the world-renowned hero of the United States. And this hurt Paine's reputation. But it was not without justification on the part of Paine to have written this, except that it was a tragedy on both sides. Paine didn't know, Washington didn't know he was in prison. When, however, Monroe succeeded this wretch, Morris, he got him out and saved his life, and he and Mrs. Monroe nursed him back to health until he was as healthy as he ever got to be. In other words, he never fully recovered his health, but he got as healthy as ever got again at the Monroe household. The other thing I want to say about this situation, at the time that Paine was in this condition, in prison, while he was in prison, it's very interesting, his cellmate was a British general who, ironically, is the one who surrendered at Yorktown. To speak of coincidences of world history, his cellmate was a British general who was General Cornwallis's aide-de-camp. And Cornwallis was sick the day of the surrender. You can see why. And he just didn't feel up to it, to surrender. So he got his junior officer, also a junior general, to do the actual surrendering. The guy who actually surrendered at Yorktown, which is the last battle of the American War for Independence, which terminated the war, this general was Paine's cellmate while he was in prison, and they got to be good friends. Moreover, and this is interesting and illustrative of Thomas Paine's character, the general, the British general, was released as a British subject and allowed to go home with one condition. He had to finance his own fare back. He didn't have the money. Paine supplied it to him. This man who was always in the depths of poverty somehow managed to save some money, a fairly large number of British pounds, and he had stuffed it into the keyhole in the cell in which he was lodged, and he was able to manage to salvage it, and figuring he's going to be killed anyhow, he pulled it out of the keyhole and gave this man the money to go back to England with. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the fact is that Paine's life was mainly a tragic one. When he finally got out of prison, he stayed a few more years in France. He didn't dare come back to the United States, but there's a war going on between England and France. And if he got on a boat, the British, who had the supremacy of the sea and could have stopped any ship flying the French or American flag, as you know, the British did do this, which is what caused the War of 1812. They used to stop even American vessels while America was neutral and take off people. Well, if Payne had been on one of those boats, well, he was not going to risk that with the British. So he stayed in France till the war against France, between France and England, ended. And at that time, in 1802, he came back to America. And he found, much to his horror, he was a hated and denounced man. And he was even denied the right to vote in the country he founded by some local little wretch in the town he lived in, New Rochelle. Remember, that's where he had a farm. He was even denied the right to vote in his own, in the country that he founded, on the grounds that he wasn't an American citizen. But that wasn't the real reason. That was just a pretext that was sought. The reason he was denounced, the reason he was unpopular, the reason he was hated, is because while in France, he had also written a book on religion, which made him exceedingly unpopular. The book is Age of Reason. It is, in my opinion, one of the greatest books ever written in the history of the world. It will probably last to the day that the last human being breathes. I don't wish to go into the subject matter of the book, the reason he wrote it, or what he said. Let it suffice to say that what he said was sufficiently unpopular. He was always unpopular. But this time he really hit the panic button. On this one, what he said about the king just offended monarchists. But this one affected everyone. Everyone who believed in the Bible. See, he didn't much care for the Bible. And he wrote this book on religion. And he got denounced as an atheist in a world where atheists are not highly regarded. And as a matter of fact, it happens that he is not an atheist. As a matter of fact, I would like to prove to you that he is not an atheist and show you how ignorant the average human being is. Because the average human being calls this book, calls Thomas Paine an atheist for having written this book, and it says, and you have to go very deep into the book, up to page one. On page one, it says, in simple, clear, unequivocal English, I believe in one God and no more. It says many other things, but that's on page one. It so happens he didn't believe in God the way other people believed in God. He believed in God in a different way. And I'm not going into the details of that. That would be a course in its own right. All I want to say is, because it was an unpopular way of believing, it was an unorthodox position, he got denounced as an atheist, as the agent of the devil, as Satan on earth, and he was soundly hated and thoroughly denounced. A couple of libelous biographies appeared, one during his life and one right after it, by James Cheatham, in which he was denounced as a filthy, dirty, sexually promiscuous, intemperate, drunkard, a lout. All of these things are historically untrue. The man I mentioned before, Moncure D. Conway, spent a substantial effort in investigating the historical background of Paine and his times, and none of these charges are true. These were merely conjured up for the purpose of denouncing a great man. This is always the situation. When you cannot argue with a man's ideas, you insult him, and you denounce his personality, and you attack him on grounds of personal slander and vituperation and scurrilous attacks on his character. Thomas Paine, as a matter of fact, was probably never seen drunk. He did drink. Most people did in those days and even today. But to drink and to be drunk are two different things. He was never seen in drunk. He was probably one of the cleanest personal individuals, according to Conway's research. Do you think he would have been the house guest of Thomas Jefferson in the White House if he had been a pig? Well, the only man who didn't desert Thomas Paine in his last sad years in America was Thomas Jefferson, his old friend, who as president invited him as his personal guest to the White House, where they talked over old times for a few weeks. I might add one more thing about Paine, about his book on religion, without going into any further details or depth about it. As I say, an unpopular view is always one which meets with denunciation. The view that Thomas Paine had on religion is called deism. It's the religion of all the major thinkers of the 18th and 17th and 18th, or for that matter, the 19th and 20th centuries. Most of the great scientists of history had the same religious view. It also happens that the then President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, had the same identical religious view that Paine had, but was not denounced for it because the difference was he was a politician and he didn't choose to write a book about it. He held these views in the privacy of his own mind, but didn't bother to write it up. That's too unpopular an ideology. It is historically accurate, and every major historian has reported it, that amongst the deists of the period were, besides Jefferson, also Madison, Monroe, Benjamin Franklin, and although Washington was officially a member of the, I believe, Episcopalian, or I think it was the Episcopalian Church, although he held church membership, he was in his mind and in his practical attitude a deist. John Adams was a Unitarian, or rather John Adams was a deist, and John Quincy Adams, his son, was a Unitarian, which is the closest organized religion to deism. And so practically all of the major political figures of the period were deists, but they didn't make a noise about it. The only difference between Paine and the rest of them was that he wrote a book. So much for that. The fact of the matter is that Thomas Paine's authorship of the Declaration of Independence merits the title Founder of the United States for him. I frankly think even if he had not authored it, just writing common sense would merit that title. But let me just, since I have said it so much, prove to you that he did write the Declaration of Independence, and I'll try to do it as quickly as I can. I am not the founder of the idea that he wrote the Declaration of Independence. Most of the things in this course are my own views, especially the next session, which will relate it to the 20th century ideology. And I want to make it clear that the next step, the next few remarks are not my innovation. I did not discover the fact that Paine wrote the Declaration of Independence. I merely suspected it as a child. No, child, 19 years of age. That's when I first heard of Thomas Paine, when I was 19, and I was incarcerated in the army. And while I was serving my sentence in the army, in World War II, I ran across Thomas Paine, and I read as a soldier slave the works of Thomas Paine. And that's when I found out that the philosophy of Thomas Paine is so much like the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence, I suspected that he might be the author, but I didn't know this. Then I ran across a pamphlet by a man called Philip van der Weyde, who proved it in a few conclusive steps that he is, and that convinced me. And then when I came out of servitude in the army, I found right after World War II, a book was published and advertised in the New York Times, of which at that time I was a subscriber, a full-page ad advertising this book, Thomas Paine, Author of the Declaration of Independence, by Joseph Lewis. And this originally came out in 1947. By this time I knew he was the author through the earlier pamphlet of Philip van der Weyde. I was so excited to see that a whole book had been written on this great topic. I immediately bought it, and I've never changed my view. I'm certain that he is the author, and the views that I'm going to give you here are partly those of Joseph Lewis, or rather mainly those of Joseph Lewis, and a little bit from the earlier writings of Philip van der Weyde, and a few of my own remarks will be interspersed in here. I wish to say that although this part of the course is due to Joseph Lewis, I wish to, for his protection as well as my own, say that the rest of the views in this course are not Joseph Lewis's, and in other words, just the part on proving he is the pain is the author, because I cannot say that Mr. Lewis would endorse this course, and I in turn don't endorse everything he stands for. I do not think Mr. Lewis is a capitalist. I don't think he understands what Thomas Paine's major importance in history was. I don't think the book that he wrote is particularly a good piece of literature in terms of how he wrote it. In other words, he's not an eloquent writer. He thinks he is, but I don't. Some of the arguments are very rational and some are not. So you have to take some good with the bad in this book. But basically there are enough arguments that some do not convince, frankly, but some are very convincing. And the totality of these views is such that it is, in my mind, incontrovertible that Paine is the author of the Declaration of Independence. The quotations I read you in the first session of this course about the sentiments prior to the movement for independence, which I said I would identify in the second session, came from this book, Thomas Paine, author of the Declaration of Independence. Now, the fact is that there is no single proof in my mind, but one, that conclusively, there is no single fact that proves that Thomas Paine is the author of the Declaration of Independence. But there are a large number of clues, the totality of which conclusively prove that Paine is the author. No one of them by itself does it. It's very similar to a detective story converted to finding. It's a whodunit, except that in this case it's not whodunit in the sense of a murder, but whodunit in the sense of who wrote the declaration. You look for clues. Maybe no one clue is conclusive, but the totality of them is such that it does prove it. Why? Well, first of all, each clue says, well, only a few people could have done this. And then you name them. Thomas Paine, Patrick Henry, and Joe Zilch. Another one, who could have done this? Another clue. Samuel Adams, Thomas Paine, and John Doe. And name another clue. And you find that in all instances, Paine is in there. In some of them, Samuel Adams is. In some of them, Patrick Henry is. In some of them, someone else is. In some of them, maybe 5 or 10 or 20 people fill the bill. But Thomas Paine is the only one who fits all the clues without exception. The others are weeded out by, they fit one clue, but they don't fit another clue. Thomas Paine fits every last one of them. It's on that process of elimination that I'm going to say that Paine is the author. In my own mind, I cannot say that he is the author of the Declaration of Independence with 100% certainty, because the only way I could really say that is if I were an eyewitness to it, and contrary to the opinion of some people, I was not there, and I did not see him actually write it. On the other hand, I also was not present at the time that Napoleon Bonaparte crowned himself Emperor of France, but I rather think that there's substantial historical evidence for it, so I take it as proven. And I was not there at other historical events, but there are enough clues to prove this. I can say that I am not 99% convinced, but 100% convinced that Jefferson is not the author of the Declaration of Independence. That is, in my mind, 100% established. Whether Paine is the... Obviously, it has an author. He didn't write itself. If Jefferson isn't, then somebody else must be. And then of the many people who are eligible possibilities, only Paine fits all the clues now. So I should say that the chances are overwhelming that it is most likely that Paine is it. And I personally would evaluate the percentages higher than 99% sure. And that's as close as I think we can get. Unless we find something still better. And that's the original draft in Paine's handwriting, which I think doesn't exist. I think it was deliberately destroyed for the reason to conceal the authorship. The reason for the concealment of the authorship, if it was concealed, and I think it was deliberately concealed, is for the same reason that Thomas Paine couldn't at first admit he wrote Common Sense, and he said he published it anonymously. because his image just wasn't that great at that time. For the same reason, he couldn't be proclaimed as the author of this document. What position did he have? You know, in the 18th century world, position and social status and prestige counted for a very great deal. Same is true today, except that the emphasis has shifted from, let's say, aristocracy and nobility. It has shifted to political offices and perhaps scholastic and academic titles. But it's a class society where people are judged not by what they are, but what they are, not by what they think, but what they are in terms of what position they hold. Paine had no positions. He was a wandering immigrant into America, which became the United States. He was not a member of the Continental Congress. If the Declaration of Independence was to be recognized the world over by France, by Spain, by Russia, by Austria, by other nations, after all, the United States was seeking public recognition as an independent nation. It had to be recognized by these other countries, France especially, because France ultimately came to war against England on behalf of the colonies, the United States. Therefore, to gain stature, an official body had to put this document out, not just some individual person who happened to live in the colony and say, I wrote this, we're now free. So it had to come out from what is called an official body, the Continental Congress. Paine was not a member of the Continental Congress. He was not the caliber that ever would be. He was not a committee man. Jefferson was. The authorship had to be attributed to one of the members. And so Jefferson was the chairman of the committee to draft the Declaration of Independence. What they probably did was they hired Thomas Paine to actually do the writing, and then they said it came out of this committee, and Jefferson was the chairman of the committee, and he was well known as a good writer, so it was unofficially attributed to him. I wish to emphasize that, unofficially. It was never officially attributed. He never was written into the records of any state or any other so-called official body as the author. There is no claim by Thomas Jefferson personally ever in his life except at the end to be the author. Thomas Jefferson, that is incidentally one of the proofs right there, one of the many proofs. Thomas Jefferson never claimed to be the author except at the end of his life. He wrote his own epitaph a year or two prior to his death, and his death, by the way, occurred on July 4th, 1826, exactly 50 years to the day of the Declaration of Independence's official dating. And another historical coincidence, John Adams died the same day. He was also on the committee to draft the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on the same day, exactly 50 years to the day after the Declaration of Independence. Never, except about a year or two prior to his death, when he wrote his epitaph, did he ever claim to be the author. When he wrote his epitaph, he said he's the author of the Declaration of Independence. And the author of the Virginia Bill on Religious Freedom or something, and the founder of the university in Virginia, something like that. That's the only place he claimed it. Now you may say, well, why did he claim it then if he didn't write it? That's easy. That is easy to explain. First of all, nobody was around to really remind him by this time. Paine had died over a decade and a half earlier. He died in 1809. The only man who really knew who wrote it was dead. Am I calling Jefferson a crook? No. He forgot. Now you may say, that's ridiculous. How could he forget that? Very easily. Very easily. Thomas Jefferson, when he died, was 84 years old. Very few men at that age are not senile. I happen to have known a few in my life who were in full possession of their minds at that age. One of them is Mr. Hoyles. Another was Mr. Heath. I knew a few others. But most men of that age are senile. And they don't remember well. The great Michael Faraday, at an earlier age, the great experimental physicist, at a much younger age, had to quit experimenting because he couldn't remember anything. He would do an experiment, and the next day he would do the same experiment, and he'd suddenly remember, gee, I did that yesterday. And he forgot all about it. Most men's memories fail them at their late years. Secondly, even apart from his age, it is also true that memory dims even for people who are not senile. Let me ask you something. Supposing you find something that you wrote 20 or 30 years ago as a school child, for instance, and you run across it maybe 20 or 30 years later, can you positively remember where it came from, whether that was composed by you or whether you copied it from somewhere else? In general, you cannot. Moreover, Thomas Jefferson had heard for 50 long years everyone referred to him as the author of the Declaration of Independence, and he finally believed it. After all, he did chairman the committee to draft it. He was present, and he saw the thing being argued about all the time, and he had it in his hands all this time, and there is a document in his own handwriting called the Rough Draft of the Declaration of Independence, which is the one I referred to before as the original. That is in his handwriting. This last one is not. That's in the handwriting of Timothy Matlock. But I think it's called Timothy Matlock, the fellow who actually was he had the penmanship, but not the authorship. But there is one in his handwriting, in Jefferson's handwriting. He did write one, so it might have slipped his mind that they hired someone to ghostwrite it. And as I say, with all these years and all that evidence of time, all that weight of time and all the evidence of people calling him the author, it's quite possible it just slipped his mind that he had it ghostwritten. I think it's more significant that in his earlier years, when he was a young man, a middle-aged man, when he was president of the United States, he did not claim authorship. That's more significant. And if he were the author, you might think that the man who ran for president of the United States, a tough campaign, I might add, because he nearly got licked by Aaron Burr, you know. When he was running, that would have been an excellent campaign issue if it were true. I'm the author of the Declaration of Independence. I think that would have been a hell of a good thing for him to say if he were. And he didn't claim it when he was at the height of his mental powers. And he didn't claim it. And that would have been the best campaign speech he could have made, that he wrote the country's birth certificate. He didn't claim it. That's only one point, and a relatively minor one at that. Then there's another one. The word hath appears in there. Remember I called your attention to it? And I called your attention to it in Paine's writings. It appears all the time in Paine's writings. And it appears right there in the Declaration of Independence. All experience hath shown. Seventh line in the penmanship version. Jefferson didn't use that word. He was a very prolific author. He actually wrote more words for publication in his lifetime than Paine did. Paine wrote less, just more deeply. Jefferson was a very prolific author. Nowhere in his writings does the word hath appear, except when he's quoting somebody else. Well, that's what he's doing here. He's quoting somebody else. If that was not part of his vocabulary, why? It's an archaic word. He wrote in modern English. Why didn't Paine? He was a Quaker. Or more accurately, he was a Quaker in his youth. He became a deist later. He was a Quaker by upbringing. Quakers are taught to speak in old-fashioned English. They're very conservative in their linguistic styles. They still talk in these and thous. And they have old-fashioned writing styles. And Paine had it. And that was his writing style. Now, is Paine the only one who used the word hath? No. Some others did. Patrick Henry used the word hath. So this clue, if this were the only clue, this slips in Patrick Henry. It slips in quite a few other people. Paine was not the only one who used hath, but Jefferson is not one who did. There were some who did besides Paine. So this only says Paine could be the author, and so could Patrick Henry, and so could anyone who used the word hath. How about the next point? Declaration of Independence uses the word unalienable. If you look at the rough draft of the Declaration of Independence, which, by the way, the Joseph Lewis book I just referred to has the entire rough draft in it, and it goes on from the facsimile of the handwriting, it goes on for many pages, and so on. This Declaration of Independence, the original rough draft, in Jefferson's handwriting says, inalienable, not unalienable. What does that mean? Somebody made a transcription error, if that's what it is. Well, I'll come back to this. It is not a transcription error. It means that they're not written by the same person. But I'll come back to it a little later. The next proof that Paine is that Jefferson is not and Paine might be the author is the tirade against the British king, which occupies about two-thirds of the Declaration of Independence. That is perfectly in keeping with Paine's attitude towards the royal brood of Britain. It is not in keeping with the refined, urbane manners of a polished gentleman, Thomas Jefferson, who, though he didn't particularly enjoy the British king's manners, he wouldn't talk about them with the words, the vigor, the venom of Thomas Paine. Remember what I read you before in connection with slavery? He has prostituted his negative. Another place, he has waged cruel war against human nature itself. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain. Thomas Jefferson would not be violently opposing the king in terms like these. He'd just say, tut, tut, old man, be a little bit nicer fellow. Paine was a fiery man. He was fiery from the inside out. There was nothing about him that weasel worded. He never cut anything in strength. He never compromised. He didn't politic. Jefferson was a politician. He was interested in pleasing other people so they would agree with him. Paine didn't give a damn. The next point. The same Thomas Paine that launched a tirade against the British king also didn't like slavery. The original draft of the Declaration of Independence, I already read you what it said. Do you suppose Thomas Jefferson would put that in when he's a slaveholder? The only way you could imagine that, ladies and gentlemen, is if you say that Thomas Jefferson is a hypocrite. I am not prepared to call him a hypocrite because I have too much of a respect for Jefferson himself. Not as much as for Paine, but I have enough of a respect for Jefferson not to call him a hypocrite. And a man would have to be the world's worst hypocrite to write this about slavery into the rough draft and then hold slaves himself. Now you may say, but it was cut out. Of course it was cut out. That couldn't slip through in a million years. Not with the Continental Congress having a load full of Southern plantation owners. It was cut out. It was the first thing to go. Why would Thomas Jefferson put something like that in, as controversial as that, when he knows damn well it'll be cut out? Why should he even invoke their anger when he's trying to get along with them, trying to be their friends? After all, these are the men he had to live with every day of his life. He had to see them every day. Why should he invoke such a criticism and such a controversy? Whereas Paine, to him everything was a mathematical model of precision, like his bridge. It's either right or it's wrong. If it's wrong, he doesn't give a damn who likes it. He put it in because he figured, if there's only one chance in a million, they might not notice it. It might slip through. And even if they cross it out, that's their doing, not mine. I put it in. At least his conscience was clear. But Jefferson wouldn't have put it in. Moreover, if you say all this isn't enough, then if he did put it in, if Jefferson did write it and did put it in, and it was crossed out, then I ask you this. Why didn't he free his own slaves? He could have freed his own slaves, even if the others weren't freed, but he didn't. He's freed no slaves in his lifetime. Not a one. In his will, he provided for the emancipation of his three most advanced slaves, advanced in culture and intellectual advancement. Jefferson's views on slavery are pretty well known. He wrote about it. His views on slavery were such that he believed in a gradual emancipation of slavery, but he felt that the Negro people would have to first advance into a position of more responsibility before they would be ripe for emancipation. Paine took the more radical and more violent, radical not in the communist, but in the fundamental and original sense. He took the more fundamental and more original and more moral position. Slavery cannot be justified on the grounds that we think these people are too primitive. What if they are primitive? That's their problem. They'll learn. When they're put into the marketplace, they'll learn. And they would if you leave them alone. And so he said, you cannot justify such an evil. Well, then there are things in the Declaration of Independence of such universal significance. The tirade against the King of England is not universal. But the first third of the Declaration of Independence, which I stressed in the first session, this is the most universal document of individual sovereignty ever penned until the 20th century. Nothing beats it in the 18th, nothing beats it in the 19th, nothing beats it in most of the 20th. That's of universal significance. The principles of the Declaration of Independence will stand the test of time, will be right in 10,000 years. This is the same man who said, this is the cause of all mankind. This is the one who recognized that this is for posterity. Jefferson was a provincial man. He was not a man of universal perspective. He was a provincial individual. To him, his country was Virginia, not the United States. He was first a Virginian and second an American. As most Southerners felt, and incidentally this led to the Civil War. Robert E. Lee had the same attitude. Robert E. Lee, for example, did not believe in slavery, did not wish secession, did not want civil war, and he was offered the Union command by Abraham Lincoln. And he reluctantly refused it. Because he had to make the decision. Is he first a Virginian or is he first an American? And he decided he's first a Virginian. So did Jefferson think this way. That's a local and provincial position. Paine was not first an American. He was not first a Virginian or a Pennsylvanian or an Englishman or a Frenchman. He was a man of the world. He was a citizen of the world, the first one. And he called himself that in those specific words. He said, my own mind is my own church. My religion is to do good. And my country is the world. He had a universal attitude, embracing all continents and all centuries. The Declaration of Independence was not written by a provincial mind, but by a man of universal caliber. Next point on the Declaration of Independence, by the way, that point is not Joseph Lewis's, that's mine. The others are Joseph Lewis's. The next point on the Declaration of Independence that you can show, there are many others, I'll cut this brief to a short form. For example, here's a point, for example. This is from the rough draft of the Declaration. I'm quoting. At this very time, too, they are permitting their chief, that means the king, their chief, to send over not only soldiers of our common blood, but Scotch and foreign mercenaries to invade and deluge us in blood. Scotch and foreign mercenaries. Thomas Jefferson lived in a part of Virginia where most of his friends and neighbors were Scotsmen. The Randolphs of Virginia. He personally was partially of Scotch descent himself, probably. A Scotsman does not refer to Scotchmen or Scotsmen as Scotch and foreign, as lumping Scotchmen with foreigners. But Thomas Paine, was an Englishman, not a Scotsman. And as you probably know from history, the Scotch and British or English people are not only not the same people, they don't even like each other. They are forcibly joined in a union of political coercion. They used to be two separate kingdoms. And then James VI of Scotland became James I of England. And the two countries were merged under the regime of James I, whose last name was Stuart, and he was a Scotch king. He became the English king. And it's only through a political coercive union that the two countries are the same. But to this day, the English and the Scotch don't look upon each other as the same people, no more than the Germans and the Italians look upon each other as the same people. They're two different people. The fellow who wrote this looked upon Scotsmen as foreigners. Jefferson couldn't have.
Not where he lived, not with his ancestry. That's a rather subtle point, but it did not escape the attention of Joseph Lewis. Another subtle point, even more subtle perhaps. In the Declaration of Independence, the expression, false fact. That doesn't make sense. All facts are true. There are no false facts. That's a poetic way of speaking. Jefferson, on this point, was more of a purist than Paine. Jefferson never would have tolerated such an error in precision. This is one of the few places where Paine was sloppy, but he did it for poetic license. It sounded better. Another point is the resemblance of the phraseology of the Declaration of Independence with things that are known to be of Paine's authorship, and Joseph Lewis makes some arguments, some strong, some weak, in this book by running parallel columns between writings that are known to be Jefferson's, known to be Paine's, and corresponding passages from the Declaration. He shows that the phraseology or the forceful terminology is quite similar. He quotes from the Maritime Compact, which was written by Paine. He quotes from the Pennsylvania Preamble to the Constitution, which is known to have been written by Paine. He quotes from Common Sense, which of course was written by Paine. And he shows that many of the, not only the ideas, but the phraseologies are similar. Some of these points by Lewis are stronger than others. Some of these comparisons are stronger than others. And finally, and most powerfully, is a very interesting proof that Paine is the author, involving the most detective work. At the same time, it is the most conclusive proof, except for the slavery one. I think the single most conclusive one is the business on slavery. But the second most conclusive one is also the most subtle. Joseph Lewis, I believe, is the one who should get the credit for having discovered publicly and publicly stated that there is another rough draft of the Declaration of Independence in existence besides the one in Jefferson's handwriting. Everyone knows about the one in Jefferson's handwriting because it's kept in the same place in the National Archives or Library of Congress or wherever it's kept. It's kept in Washington at the same in the same place where the final declaration is kept, the rough draft in Jefferson's handwriting. But there's also a less known and more and very less visited rough draft in the handwriting of John Adams, who was also on the committee. This one originally was retained by the John Adams family and later got into the Massachusetts Historical Association, where it is now. And Joseph Lewis got permission to reproduce it. This one I'm holding aloft now is the rough draft in Adams' handwriting. This also goes on for a number of pages. This one is not mutilated the way the Jefferson one is, because it's the Jefferson one that was the working copy from which this one was made. That's the one that got mutilated and the slavery passage was cut out and all the things. I showed you a few minutes ago the Jefferson rough draft. You can see all the ink blots and all the crossings out. The Adams copy doesn't have it. Now, this one's in Adams' handwriting. The reason that this proves that Paine wrote it, or more accurately, is one of the clues, is that this is almost the same as the one in Jefferson's handwriting prior to the scratchings out. But there are a few significant differences. And it's in those differences that the importance arises. The differences are quite significant. One is the John Adams one says unalienable, the same as the final version. The Jefferson one says inalienable. So you say, so what? Well, obviously, if neither is the original, then they both must have gotten it from somewhere else, and one transcribed it the way it was written, and the other one transcribed it the way he prefers the word. That was Jefferson's preferred version, inalienable. He was a man of strong character, and he changed it to fit his own style. John Adams was a man of more passive nature. Remember, he's the one who said, I could not have written in so strong and manly a style. He said that himself about Common Sense. He copied it just the way he saw it. This may or may not be his style, but he copied it the way he saw it. Jefferson changed it. And apparently, in their final draft, they got changed back to unalienable. But there's something more interesting yet about the John Adams version. There are several somethings in there besides that. One of them is, well, I won't go into all of them because it would take too long and we're running out of time. I just want to take the main point that is different. And this is the blockbuster. In the John Adams version, and you will find that many of the nouns, common nouns, are written with capital letters. I'll just read you the first sentence, and I'll indicate which are capital, which letters are which nouns have an initial capital letter. When in the course of human events, course is written with a capital C, events with a capital E, it becomes necessary for a people, capital P, to advance from that subordination, capital S, in which they have hitherto remained, and to assume among the powers of the earth, capital P on powers, capital E on earth, the equal and independent station, capital S, to which the laws, capital L, of nature, capital N, and of nature's God, capital N on nature's and capital G on God, etc., etc. I don't want to go on. But this is the way the whole thing is written. Every important noun is capitalized. Not every noun, but every important noun. Why? That isn't the way John Adams normally wrote. And that isn't the way most people write. And that isn't the way Thomas Jefferson wrote. Now let's look at the Jefferson version. Not the final version in Timothy Matlock's handwriting, the one in Jefferson's handwriting. I'll tell you which ones are capitalized. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, etc., etc. I didn't stop once. Not a single capital letter on any one of these nouns, including God, which practically everyone capitalizes these days. They're all small letters. So you say, so what? So this. There are only four possibilities, ladies and gentlemen, and that's a logically full course of possibilities. Either John Adams is the author of the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson copied his version. That's one possibility. Or Thomas Jefferson is the author of the Declaration of Independence and John Adams copied his version. Or neither is the author of the Declaration of Independence, they both copied it from somebody else, or they composed it independently. The latter possibility you can discount totally, because the probability of two human beings writing the same thing without knowledge of each other, which are this close but yet not exactly the same, but which have the same words and are a document this long with nearly identical phraseology, that two human beings should write verbatim the same thing is almost one chance that it's incalculably small. As a matter of fact, I don't think it's incalculable, but it would take a while to figure it out. It would probably take longer for this possibility to happen than the age of the universe. So we'll skip that one. At least three possibilities. Thomas Jefferson is the author and Adams copied it. John Adams authored it and Jefferson copied it. Neither wrote it, and they both copied it. Let's exclude the first two, and that leaves only the last. John Adams cannot be the author, so that Jefferson should copy it for a number of reasons. Number one, these sentiments are not his. His whole life is a living refutation of what in the case of Thomas Jefferson, there are only a couple of minor refutations, like Scotch and foreign mercenaries and the slavery business, and he wasn't as powerful a writer. And he wouldn't have said so strong, used such a strong language. But basically, these are his sentiments, too. Jefferson mainly felt this way, too. Not Adams. These are totally alien to his thinking. He and Jefferson were lifetime political foes. This is totally contrary to John Adams' philosophy. Moreover, this is not in his writing style. He admitted it himself, referring to common sense. When people thought he wrote it, I could not have written in such a manly style. This is even more so. He also didn't capitalize nouns. Why would he suddenly go berserk and start capitalizing nouns on this one document? So we exclude that possibility. Let's take the other possibility. Jefferson is the author and Adams copied it. This is what everybody believes, that Jefferson is the author. Well, if Jefferson is the author, why should John Adams, in copying this from Jefferson, change all these things? Why should he capitalize every letter that he normally wouldn't do anyhow? The only letter that I think John Adams might have capitalized would be God. All the others, course of human events, why should he capitalize C in course? What would make him do it if it didn't read that way in the original? Why should he change inalienable to unalienable? So the possibility of his making these changes is ruled out by the fact that this is not in his writings, not in his own writing style, and it's certainly not in that of the one that Jefferson wrote. And therefore, it was not copied from Jefferson. It was copied from somewhere else. That leaves the final and last possibility. Someone else wrote it. Well, now you can guess who. Because all the other clues, this doesn't tell you that Paine was the other author, but it does tell you there was another author. And all the other clues show that it was Paine. There are probably at least 50 others I could give you reasons, but time does not permit. I think this suffices. You can read this book yourself. There are other things interesting in this book. And even if you're not convinced, the fact of the matter is, he did write Common Sense, and it would be no great genius to figure out that the Declaration of Independence is inspired by Common Sense. But with these additional proofs, you can assume that the possibility is incontrovertibly in favor of having been written by Paine. There's one last thing I wish to do this evening and give you the best biography of Thomas Paine possible, better than what I said in the last few hours. I want to read you a few quotations from Thomas Paine. Because if you read some quotations from a man's own writings, you get a better picture of this man's thinking, his life, his way of achieving things than if you merely read about him in a biography or listen to others. Because when you hear about a man from someone else, a biographer, a lecturer, those are the opinions of the biographer or the lecturer. The best biography of any man is his intellectual biography, to see how he thought. And that you get from his own writings, where he is not misquoted or perhaps calumnied or perhaps whitewashed, but he's saying what was his. And I wish to read you some sample quotations. They are in no particular order. They are not from the same writing. They are merely extracted from a collection of his quotations, which Joseph Lewis, the same Joseph Lewis I just mentioned, put out. These are, it's called The Inspiration and Wisdom from the Writings of Thomas Paine. He just collected a lot of nice quotations, and I in turn boiled down a few of those, and they are in no particular order except that they are all typical of his thinking. Independence is my happiness, and I view things as they are, without regard to place or person. My country is the world, and my religion is to do good. It is necessary to the happiness of man that he be mentally faithful to himself. It is easy to tell a lie, but it is difficult to support the lie after it is told. My own mind is my own church. This is one of the reasons he wasn't liked too well. I prefer the other kind. I believe that religion consists not in believing or disbelieving, but in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigues of supporting it. Some of these quotations are quite famous, except most people don't know where they come from. This is one very famous quotation, except I dare say most people don't know where it came from. Of course, there's the famous one I don't have here. These are the times to try men's souls. That's an even more famous one. The next one is one of my favorites. Actually, they all are. I love the man that can smile in trouble, that can gather strength from distress, and grow brave by reflection. 'Tis the business of little minds to shrink, but he whose heart is firm and whose conscience approves his conduct will pursue his principles unto death. See, he lived this. The mere guillotining of him proves it. He does not compromise even when the guillotine stares him in the face. The beautiful thing about Thomas Paine is he was not a hypocrite. He believed what he wrote. And he lived his life accordingly. The next one is even one even better as far as being one of my favorites. To argue with a man who has renounced the use and authority of reason and whose philosophy consists in holding humanity in contempt is like administering medicine to the dead. Certain as I am that when opinions are free, either in matters of government or religion, truth will finally and powerfully prevail. An army of principles will penetrate where an army of soldiers cannot. It will succeed where diplomatic management would fail. It is neither the Rhine, the Channel, nor the ocean that can arrest its progress. It will march on the horizon of the world and it will conquer. That's the army of principles. The mind, once enlightened, cannot again become dark. That, incidentally, is one of the key points to ideological strategy for the future. The mind, once enlightened, cannot again become dark. It ought not be that because we cannot do everything, that we ought not do what we can. Morality is injured by prescribing to it duties that are impossible to be performed. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. The cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. The more men have to lose, the less willing they are to venture. That, by the way, explains why in the 20th century there are so many rich New Dealers and rich socialists. The more men have to lose, the less willing are they to venture. They have a vested interest in what they've got, and they are unwilling to take risks. I do not permit the whole of my mind, nor ever did, to be engaged or absorbed by one object only. A law not repealed continues in force not because it cannot be repealed, but because it is not repealed, and the non-repealing passes for consent. The next one is one of the most fundamental points ever written in the history of freedom. A casual discontinuance of the practice of despotism is not a discontinuance of its principles. The former depends on the virtue of the individual who is in immediate possession of power. The latter on the virtue and fortitude of the nation. That, if properly interpreted, leads to a free society in the 20th century. That last quotation. Paine is actually the antecedent of many of the modern concepts that can be used in the 20th century. Society is the guardian, but not the giver. The government of a free country, properly speaking, is not in the persons, but in the laws. You have to interpret laws as natural laws to make this mean something. And Paine did mean natural laws, incidentally. If you take this in context. If a government requires the support of oaths, it is a sign that it is not worth supporting and ought not to be supported. Make a government what it ought to be, and it will support itself. The present-day conservatives are very strong for loyalty oaths. I'll read this again. If a government requires the support of oaths, it is a sign that it is not worth supporting and ought not to be supported. Make a government what it ought to be and it will support itself. It is cheaper to corrupt than to conquer. We talk of religion. Let us talk of truth. For that which is not truth is not worthy of the name of religion. The Bible is a book that has been read more and examined less than any book ever existed. Who can say by what exceedingly fine action of fine matter it is that a thought has produced in what we call the mind? And yet that thought, when produced, as I now produce the thought I am writing, is capable of becoming immortal, and is the only production of man that has that capacity. That is a rudimentary acknowledgement of the principles upon which Course V201, the most advanced course of the Free Enterprise Institute, is founded, the nature and protection of primary property. Primary property is property in thinking or in thoughts. In other words, that's the most durable product, a good thought. Nothing is more easy than to find abusive words. And finally, one doubtful thing cannot be admitted as proof that another doubtful thing is true. That is a universal mind I have just quoted from, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I have one last thing to say, and that is, what is the application of all this stuff on Thomas Paine and the Declaration of Independence to the 20th century's supreme crisis, the one we are immersed in, which if we don't handle it properly, will cost every last one of us our lives and every last one of us our freedom. I don't know in which order. Well, either our freedom first and then our lives, or our lives and our freedom together. Every last one of us will be wiped out as far as free individuals in the near foreseeable future due to the demonstrably corrupt and degenerate forces that have produced a decay of a culture not yet 200 years old. We have the supreme crisis of world history, and I maintain that what Thomas Paine started is the beginning of a much larger concept of freedom, a much larger American Revolution, and a much larger concept which is anchored still to the Newtonian principles of rational scientific thinking, from which you can develop a much higher level social structure. And what I wish to say in the next session and the last session of this course is how this relates to your freedom and your life and your survival in the 20th century.